left the plague planet again.
I am an eater of the Neverborn,
he told any who asked. That, too, is unproven, and yet Vaux believes it. He believes that Slivergristle has been possessed more than once, but that his ague-shot body treats tapped intelligences as one more infection among the hundreds of others, and is thus able to dissolve them. Vaux further speculates that the youngest and most foolish of the demonic choir see this as a challenge and jostle for access to this most eccentric of hosts, hoping to master him and claim his soul. One by one, they have all been digested, leading to little more than corpuscent-lit halitosis. Such are the stories told of Slivergristle. Whether they have any basis in truth is doubtful, though his favour rides high among the many competing vicars of the plague planet.
Sage Master,
says Slivergristle, and wisps of ghost-light snag at the corners of his mouth.
Home to welcome. Travels good.
They were. Vaux's warband, the Lords of Silence, have been enjoying the favour of the god. The Imperium is becoming less able to prevent their sallies from the slowly breaking jail of the Eye, and so they have feasted on worlds.
The reaping continues, he says, in a polite formula.
They walk together towards the platform's edge. In the distant darkness, Vaux can hear lowing from the ritual abattoirs. He smells the richness of the moat-riddled air. He sees the green-tinged aurorae ripple across the jagged skyscape of spoil spires.
Aware you indeed the tidings of? Yes,
asks Silvergristle.
I have heard things, says Vaux, here and there.
True, of it all, true, and in that.
Slivergristle belches, and a puff of short-lived flame whispers in the darkness.
So skeptical. No, I would not so listen. Called back in a reason, yes, lives he.
I know the Primarch lives, Brother Vicar, says Vaux. No, lives he. Blood now boiling, just old like again it.
These rumours were known about. Word had passed across warbands like the diseases they revelled in, somehow leaping across the immense gulf of the void to be half-heard and copied and doubted. That was, after all, why Vaux had come back. There were 1,000 reasons for daring the treacherous shoals of the Eye's borders again, not least the close pursuit of more than one chapter of the Adeptus Astartes, but that was the choicest of all, that he might be roused again from introspection.
"I'd believe you more," Vaux says, "were I to see it with my own eyes."
Slivergristle grins.
"Why you are thinking back here in this now, of course. He knows all it of, and watches, now moves, after so long."
They approach an archway. The lintel is of brass, and has the figurehead of a bloated face made in scorched metal. It is hot on the plague planet, a world lit by the off-draft of furnace towers and the humid warmth of culture pools. Vaux pauses.
I have not spoken with him for a long time.
Silvergristle nods.
Shall you wait just more, not much? Why you here are, in truth?
Again, there is more than one reason. For respite, for recovery, to take counsel from Philemon, whom he wishes to take with him into Solace's bounds. To escape the weary competitions within the warband, just for a time. And yes, to dare the passage of the manse. All these things are true.
This is home, brother, Vaux says.
Slivergristle laughs and nods.
For now,
he grins.
For now, but come, change it will. Oh, yes.
First he goes to his own holdings. They are high on a ridge, like all the domains of the Unbroken, peering over the lips of precipices down into the fog-choked valleys below. That is an affectation they all adopt, taken from the distant past. Once they were not permitted to ascend into the heights. Now they dwell there exclusively, adopting the manner of those who once oppressed them. Even those who came afterwards, like Dragon, who have no memory of Barbarous, even they adopt the custom. He walks old paths, treading on lichen-sponge stone. His passage is mobbed by herds of bestials, some of whom try to touch him, others who clear the path for him. They light lanterns, and butter-yellow light spills from panels of thick, liquid glass. From time to time he spies members of his order lumbering through dark fields with scythes in hand. Some salute grimly, in the old crusade fashion. Others stare at him mutely, their soft lenses refracting in the evermirk, and he wonders if they have lost their minds at last. It happens, sooner or later, in this place. It is always night on the plague planet. No dawn sun pierces its shifting clouds, and the only constant illumination comes from below, from the phosphorescent mists and the bioluminescent fungi. Every figure is a shadow, silhouetted against that warm emerald light. Even the demons, the greatest of which loom like bloated mountains against fiery cauldrons of soul fire. He reaches his domain, which has been called Hope's Revenant ever since he raised it. He remembers delving into the black soils with his own hands, back when the land was bare and the skies were lit with Xenos whales. He remembers raising the walls above the crags, mining the soft stone and cutting it down. He remembers the scaffolds and the work gangs and the endless slaves brought from raids into real space to end their days in exhaustion and decrepitude. Now he looks at the high walls, as black as oil, the parapets lit with that ever-present soft glow. He smells the demons slithering within, the little lords and the plague-bearers who can ghost between the stones, like gas. He breathes in and smells his house plagues, the ones unique to this plot, rotting slowly in the oubliettes. For the first time in a long while, Vaux is satisfied. Occasionally he thinks of another life for himself, one confined to Hope's Revenant, where he remains closeted with the books of numerology and the gardens, free to contemplate the truth and explore its mysteries. He is never given into it, but believes that the entire Legion shares this morose tendency. The greatest of them, after all, has been indulging it for 10,000 years. He passes under the high portcullis, and those bestials blessed with elongated necks bow to him. He processes across the inner courtyard, where his steward, Loam, waits dutifully. Loam is a bestial with a long equine face and buck teeth. His brown hide is wrinkled almost into oblivion and glistens from perspiration.
"Welcome, Siege Master," Loam says.
The steward always uses the proper titles. Unlike most bestials, he can talk, although the sounds are crude and he will never be eloquent.
"How stands the citadel?"
asks Vaux, looking up at the inner walls. They are streaked with moisture, dripping slowly. Flayed corpses bump and swing from one high tower, picked at by carrion crows. From somewhere far down below, he can hear the bubble of boil vats and smell the cooking from the refectories.
"Rots," says Loam. "Topples, come home more."
Vaux smiles and keeps walking.
"I wish I could,"
he says, reaching the great doors to his private apartments. Once within, he climbs the interior stairs, treading paths that he built himself. Every worn stone is familiar. Every smell is comforting. Once he would have scorned such notions, having been made immune to all calls of family or community. Now he values these things. He tends to his herds and his slaves, seeing what can be made of them, and taking pleasure in their successes. After a long climb, he reaches his sanctuary. He takes an iron key from the ring at his belt and unlocks the door. When he pushes it open, a rich swell of old smells tumbles out, ones he has not enjoyed for a long time. He enters a grand chamber perched high at the pinnacle of the tallest tower. Bookcases line the walls, each stuffed with tome upon tome. Most are leather-backed, some bound in human hide, some in stranger coverings. They are mostly ancient, and their age seeps from them like a stink. They are all slowly mouldering away, flaking into nothingness, drooping from the extreme humidity. Worms burrow into them, gnawing trails through thick parchment. Ivory-eyed rats scuttle from stand to stand, hoarding scraps in their pink claws. The floor is knee-deep in discarded vellum. Quills scratch across writing desks, propelled by invisible hands, inscribing endless lists. Some are chronicles of years, others are typologies of phages and contagions, others are the names of allies and enemies. Vaux glances at one, the vellum rustling as the quill wobbles across its surface. Tofar, Mandravaxen, Yarnama. None of those words mean anything to him. They may do in the future, or they may not. It does not pay to listen too closely to the outputs of bound instrumental demons. He pushes his way towards a pulpit at the far end of the chamber. A single book lies open on its inclined surface, untroubled by the attentions of vermin. Its hide is as white as bone, and its pages as thick as a finger. It is impossibly huge, that book. If looked at from certain angles, it seems to go on forever, sinking deep into the library's mouldy floor, although from most aspects it is no thicker than the rest of them. He reaches for a metal quill standing in a dusty sleeve and dips it into a well of viscous ink. He holds it over the blank parchment and collects himself. Then he begins to write. Slowly, carefully, he traces out tiny letters in immaculate standard Gothic, of a grammar and idiom commensurate with the early Crusade. The first thing he writes is a name.
Brother Sergeant Caius Meldonia, Squad Taxis, 4th Company, the Emperor's Blades.
He pauses, remembering the face.
Location, Atamar, Outer Reach, Spinwood. System marker, 45563.
A faint smile crinkles across his sword-clustered lips.
The action had been prosecuted well. We were on the outward march from Tlitan.
He fills in more details, always in the same manner, not lapsing into Barbaran or Morteg, the debased vernacular of the Plague Planet, or even current-era Gothic. This record was started at the very commencement of his career in the Death Guard, and has been continued in the same vein ever since. When he finishes the entry, he carefully adds the date approximation according to both the Terran system and the Chronolattice, a scheme of his own devising that maps events to a more fluid set of points underpinned by warp dynamics. It is more accurate, at least from a number of important points of view, although it has peculiarities of its own, whereas the Imperial system becomes more inaccurate the further one is from Terra, and the further in time one is from the nominal baseline event. Chronolattice works forward to the end of the universe, a constant. Vaux names T for Thanatos, and becomes more reliable the closer the apocalypse comes. He takes time to cross-reference the entry with previous ones. He adds the relevant numbers to several interlinked grids, drawing the numerals with exactitude. Once done, he tallies certain esoteric relationships and determines if significant patterns have emerged, then logs them in a third set of ledgers. He repeats the process with ammunition loader Sylv Clude, resident of Atamar Orbital Station 4. Less is known about that death, for the stature of the victim was minuscule, but he records all that he has been able to determine, for completeness is a virtue. He has many hours of work ahead. The raiding season has been long, and he has much blood on his hands from it. He labours methodically, giving each entry just as much care as the first ones. The first biographies were written 10,000 years ago. This chronicle, this record of deaths served at his hand, stretches back to the dawn of the imperial age. For all Vorks knows, it may be the most complete history of any kind still intact. Inquisitors would sacrifice entire systems to retrieve it, if they only knew of its existence. More than one petty demon has been spun into instantiation purely as a result of symmetries picked out on the pages. Others of the Neverborn have come to Hope's Revenant and tried to consume the book, believing its contents might elevate them within their crowded and jostling pantheon. But the library is carefully guarded with ether traps and honey pits, and Vorks has designed many subtler defences to confound them. The book has no title, or, to be more precise, the book's title is also its contents. The final entry will be his own. Such psychic accumulation of killing generates a final artifact. When Vorks dies, the last page will complete itself, capping the immense and winding account of a soul's extension beyond all mortal tolerance. On that day, the tome will close, turned as if by unseen hands. The symbols will arrange and sift, the numbers will slot into new positions, and its fusion of occult symbology will reach apotheosis. It will be the final legacy of uncountable lives, stored and cross-referenced, counted and totaled, a product of magnificent uselessness. This is Vorks's great act of spite towards impermanence. He is smiling as he writes it, and the passage of time slows, dilates, warms up. He never knows how long it has taken once he stops. When he looks up again, a day might have passed, or a month, or many years. Such is the nature of the labour, and of the world on which it is performed. On this occasion, when the quill is placed back in the sleeve, and the last of the ink dries on the page, he turns to see a figure in his library. Even after so long on this strange planet, with its comings and goings of gods and demons, its creaks and groans, and its bending of the normal laws, he is taken aback. The place ought to have been secure, and he briefly wonders if his life is in danger. Then he sees who it is, and relaxes. The visitor is far more massive than he, a true giant of twisted ceramite and overspilling flesh. He even knows his name, for there are not many of this breed.
"You didn't knock, Slorn," Vorks says.
The Death Shroud Terminator does not smile, at least not obviously. His face is entirely hidden behind a landslip of helm and cowl and bursting flesh. His armour is a near black-green, like pond slime, and his ragged scraps of cloak and chasuble are a dirty grey. He breathes like an animal breathes, and his enormous slumped chest heaves with every intake. The god has been generous to him, gifting him innumerable alterations, blights and contusions. His long man-reaper scythe is warped and curving, more like a coil of rope than a length of adamantium, but it is all the deadlier for that. Slorn has been there from the start, too. He has seen the cold valleys of Barbarus and huddled in that world's freezing nights. He knows, just as Vorks does, how much better things have got.
"He's ready,"
Slorn hisses, a dry whisper through old vocal cords. Vorks prepares himself.
"So soon? You have been here 8 weeks,
says Slorn. That takes Vorks aback.
"Really? This is becoming eccentric now, Vorks. Do not rely on his favor forever. You could have done more, were it not for..."
Slorn does not need to finish that. Vorks can do it for him.
"Were it not for the obsessions, the numbers, the recording, the completion of pointless tasks."
"Well," says Vorks, "I am ready now."
"He'll be extravagantly pleased by that,"
says Slorn.
Come with me.
The manse is not widely spoken of outside the plague planet. Few, even within the Eye, know much of it, save for vague rumours of something colossal and imposing. Virtually none beyond the borders of the Hell Realm have any comprehension of it at all. For the citizens of the Corpse Empire, Mortarion has ceased to exist as anything but a warning from the past. That is as the Death Lord wishes it, and to understand this, one must understand the character of the Primarch. Even among his fallen brethren, he is a complex case. There is nothing straightforward about his rage, as one might say about that hellfire beast Angron. There is none of the control that the Witch King Lorgar learned to exercise. He has carried more with him from the past than most of his brothers, and it is said of him that everything came late and with difficulty. He was the last to succumb to the full embrace of the Pantheon. He was the last to arrive at the siege. He was the last to retreat from terror, it is rumoured, though others contest that. In Mortarion, more than in any other, is conflict. Hatred was everywhere inside him, of his father, of circumstance, of the Imperium, of himself. The poison of his foster world was hard to excise, and even if things had been handled differently by those in command, his would have been a damaged psyche. Vaux knows these things. They are not hidden from the Legion, and it does not lessen his love for his master. In his religion, damage is not something to be worried about. It is to be celebrated, cultivated, and, if possible, extended. They know, they understand, as the corpse spawn cannot, that the attempt to stave off corruption is the greatest source of disappointment. You can't keep it out. Learn to embrace it, to use it, or consign yourself to long and wearying defeat. For all that, Vaux is anxious. It has been a long time. Time flows strangely in the Eye, but it must surely have been centuries, even as measured by the plague planet's dark rotations. The Legion has got used to silence, to making its own way. Typhus, that insufferable puppet, has been the figurehead for many of them during the empty years, though even his many successors have not erased the suspicion he stimulates in the older generation.
"We really do know what you did to us,"
Vaux thinks as he travels.
"We don't forget."
He makes his way there on foot, along with Slorn. It takes them a long time, for the terrain is purposefully difficult. They wind along the steep shoulders of the pinnacles. At times they are forced down lower, where the air is like milk and the bestials run slave gangs of mortal humans. They stride past the altars, piled high with putrescence, and push their way through the squirming clots of flies. They see the mill wheels turning forever, and the bones that litter the sodden ground beneath them. After a long time, the land begins to rise. The black soils glisten with moisture, and dark leaves unfurl around them. Intelligences hiss at them from under warm shadows, and stagnant pools boil uneasily. Great menhirs lurch up along the roadside, worn by an eternity of corrosive winds. And then, at last, the walls of the manse become visible, in a caricature of defensive excess. The fortress's sheer side soar up from the green glow depths, hundreds of meters without handhold. The place is like a mountain itself, an upthrust of tectonics spreading far beyond all practical concerns and into the realm of megalomaniacal insanity. Towers thrust and spiral around one another, all spiked and hung heavily with lanterns. Stone stairways coil around the tilting flanks of the halls within, sometimes leading somewhere, sometimes terminating in kill pits or smother pans. Cathedrals to the god, empty places, rear up like abandoned tombs, mouldering away amid a mix of incense and the sweet stink of the dead, the dying, and the coming back again.
"You'll never quite get used to how huge it is,"
Vaux says dryly.
"Still growing, they say,"
says Slorn, sounding uninterested.
"The god only knows how."
This is the court of the Death Lord, and it teems with supplicants, ambassadors, sorcerers, and seers. Bestials man the kilometers-long battlements in conjunction with squatting slums of demons. Trains of pilgrims file towards the jaw gates, so numerous that they fill the causeways across half a continent. Priests of the god preach at them endlessly, their screeds punctuated by the dull tolling of cracked bells. The pilgrims stare out from moth-worn cowls, their famished eyes waiting for one of their brothers to fall, so that they might chew on a little gristle that night. Above them all swim skyships and gun barges, each leaving lines of inky smog in the hot aurora night. Beyond those are the calls of the drifting shrouds, eerie as whale calls, shimmering in ghostly inscrutability. Slaan does not need to make his presence felt here. As he and Vaux make their way towards the gates, the crowds shrink back of their own accord, abasing themselves and making the sign of three on their chests. Even the scourge demons, with their whips of infected leather, stop to stare at the death shroud. Blind grox-haulers shudder to a halt, and their wagons of softening fruit slosh on greasy axles. Bestials stare at them with big, shining eyes, panting and letting strings of saliva hang from their tusked jaws.
"Were the crowds always this big?"
asks Vaux, looking over the throngs with interest.
"They were,"
says Slaan, lumbering up to the portcullis.
"I never really know why they come."
"The same reason we do."
Slaan signals to the watchers far above. The iron bars begin to grind open.
"Only we can get in."
The gates are, like everything here, a parody. They are, it is said, 7 centimeters taller than the Eternity Gate on Terra. Just 7. Mortarion did a lot of things like that. Petty things, mediocre digs at fate. The cupola is slightly taller than that raised over the Senatorum Imperialis. The walls are steeper by 7 degrees. Still, the effect is impressive. It takes 10 minutes for the parody gates to grind open, hauled by chained gangs of bestials. Only once they're pulled apart can the gloomy interior of the manse come into view. A pile of tottering, half-ruined stacks of rotting stones, jumbling and straining upwards, ever upwards, linked by crumbling spans and spirals, creating a fragile, bloated city that juts like a nest of thorns high into the clouds above. Mist curls around its foundations, boiling against the black surfaces and leaving filmy stains on the rocks. Greater demons bellow from spell jails lodged deep in the magic-drenched towers, making the sodden earth vibrate down to the world's core.
"Best not hang around," says Slaan, pressing on. "We are already late."
It is crowded in those courtyards and terraces. Obese priests shuffle from altar to altar, accompanied by gaggles of acolytes with their upcoming sacrifices wriggling in sacks. Sorcerers stalk among them, some unbroken, wreathed in snapping whips of force. Huge, misshapen creatures, limbs stretched and bellies bloated, stagger up the twisting stairwells, lowing and huffing. There are courts within courts. In some, astrologers consult swinging orreries and tilt their astrolabes up towards the narrow slits of thick glass windows. In others, alchemists toil over bubbling racks. In yet more, surgeons sharpen their blades against whetstones before turning to shivering figures strapped to their tables. Occultists with 7 eyes scribble on stone tablets, their quills dipped into the bloody slops of the still living. Demonologists bind screaming presences within daubed septagrams, while the air pops and wobbles from the obscenity of it. Butchers swagger up from the great refectories wearing blood-stiff aprons, and pharmacists struggle under the weight of phage vials. It is noisy, burgeoning, unruly. Every stretch of flesh is poxed and sallow, every stomach slack and boil-marked. Steam pours out of brass censers, green-tinged flames belch from orifices carved within pulsating flesh walls. The chambers run deep into the earth below and high into the teetering spires above, all jammed with life and death, and the many states in between. Vaux and Slaan do not pause to observe the wonders. They move further inside, and gradually, slowly, the crowds thin out. They enter regions lit only by thin tapers, where the stone is dank and covered in slick coatings of algae. The noise fades away, and soon the only other occupants are unbroken, like themselves, sullen and silent, pursuing their own objectives within the plague city's moribund reaches.
"Silver Gristle told me he had stirred," says Vaux.
Slorn snorts.
"Listen to him, do you?"
"Of course."
"I wouldn't."
Now they are in perilous places. They pass under sagging gates and out into an abyss bridged by a single rotting ropeway. There are shafts there, delved into the heart of the planet beneath, and from them come curls of unnatural steam. Vaux can hear machinery churning a long way off, and muffled shrieks. Everything echoes in uncanny ways, as if there are walls there that shouldn't be, or rooms that remain unseen. Eventually they arrive at the inner doors, modelled on one of the Sigillite's own portals, though larger, and with the old Terran designs bastardized into earthy reflections of the god's peculiar whims. Two death shroud wait there on either side, motionless, almost invisible in the cloying dark. They say nothing, but the doors sigh open at Slorn's approach.
"I'll wait here," says Slorn.
Vaux looks at him for a moment. He wonders if this is some elaborate trap, but that seems a trifle theatrical. There are many ways to kill someone on the plague planet, after all, and no one will ever come looking for you.
"Very well,"
he says, and goes inside. This is the inner court. Vaux has been here only 3 times before. Many within the Legion, even some of the most senior, never come so far. Only the word of the Primarch himself affords admittance, and those words have been scarce. The last slivers of activity are gone. It is cold in here, and hoarfrost hangs from distant ceilings. The floor is glassy with ice. The dark pillars glitter faintly. The clouds of flies are sluggish, and they crawl rather than buzz across the shadowy vaults. Vaux walks down a long nave. In design, it is Imperial Gothic, imposing, solid, grave. His footsteps resound eerily in the high space between columns. At the end of the nave, there is a throne, shrouded in shadow. Long banners hang from spears set into the arches above, each inscribed with the names of worlds. Scrolls lie on the stone floor, half frozen, their scripts a melange of human and Xenos tongues. The throne is high-backed, fluted, and crowned with a raggedy peak of skulls. Thick cobwebs smother it, and swollen spiders squat at the heart of them. It is far bigger than any designed for mortals. It was smaller when it was first made, but its granite and ebony frame has gradually cracked and extended, swelling out along with the bulk of its owner. Vaux comes to a halt. The darkness is almost complete here. All light and heat have been drained from this place, soaked away from an empty heart. It smells fusty, like confinement.
"Welcome back, Siege Master,"
says the occupier of the throne. Vaux has seen many things over his long service, and is not easily daunted. It is impossible, however, to not be cowed by the sight of Mortarion. The Primarch was always an imposing figure, lean, drawn, sinister, even when he retained mortal dimensions. Since becoming engulfed within the Pantheon, the last fetters of restraint have been cast off. He is gigantic now, a cadaver of truly monstrous proportions. His armor has been reforged and gilded with demonic alloys. His grey flesh has atrophied further, clinging to outsized bones. His back has erupted into spines and vents, while his shoulders are now clustered with muscles for the ragged wings that drape across the throne's ripped backcloth. When he breathes, yellow-green steam vents from an ancient battered rebreather. Vaux sees a concave chest rise and fall under a corroding breastplate. Seamy eyes peer out from under the deep shadow of a threadbare cowl. Pale gauntlets grip the arms of the throne. Vaux bows.
It is good to see you again, Lord.
Mortarion stares at him. It is always hard to know what those eyes are witnessing. Vorx knows enough of the price of demonhood to know that the physical universe is something the Primarch now perceives only dimly. For all his immense power, he is clinging on, as all who make the bargain do. The majority of the possessed become howling imbeciles, given long enough. But this is a Primarch, one of the sons of the Corpse Emperor, and there is something indomitable about them, even in their compromises.
I did not foresee this, the Primarch says.
His voice is like the grate of a tomb's gate being swung lazily open.
I did not foresee the galaxy cracking.
Vorx does not know what that means, and stays silent.
I had a different future mapped, Mortarion says. I believed my part in all this was over. My duties lay on another plane.
He chuckles, which makes his neck tremble, and the macabre baubles across his armor rattle.
The Despoiler convinced me. He convinced all of us, one by one.
He coughs, and his whole body shakes, stirring the dust on the ground.
Did I know back then that it would be Abaddon? Horus's angry whelp. I often wonder if I should have. They were so alike, those two. For a long time I thought he was dead. And then I thought I'd killed him when he dared come here. But we were always wrong about him. Ha!
Vorx is not entirely sure he is being addressed. The Primarch was always prone to audible introspection, and the centuries cloistered here have only made him more solipsistic.
I'd resigned myself to what I'd become,
Mortarion says.
I kept half an eye here, half there, but mostly on the abyss. And that was the choice I'd made, to exchange the petty game for the great game, and leave the old worlds and the old wars to mortal hands.
His eyes briefly focus, and he appears to see Vorx for the first time.
But the galaxy has cracked. I do not know if the Despoiler intended that.
Vorx tries to make sense of this, and fails.
Apologies, my lord. I do not understand.
Mortarion looks confused for a moment, then recovers.
Yes. For you, it has not happened yet.
He leans forward in the throne, and the slight movement causes lines of dust to fall from the roof.
The Despoiler is ready to move. You will hear the call soon. There will be those in your service who already cleave to it and are waiting to throw in their banners with his. Not on my watch. No. Very good. But it's coming all the same.
Mortarion wheezes and draws in long breaths from the rebreather's filter.
Everything has been working towards this moment for him. I have to admit my admiration. He cannot let the past go. He worries at it like a wolf with a hunk of meat, wearing it down to the marrow. He will break the eye and loose his angels on my father's castle. And he will succeed, and that will shake the order of things. But it will not come without a price.
Vorx listens. Some of this has been hinted at by others, but he knows Mortarion sees things no others can.
I contemplated this and reflected on the count of years and what was done and what was not done, Mortarion says. And I surprised myself. I found the old itch coming back. I understood what would happen once the eye bleeds out into reality and glimpsed the chance to conclude affairs started a long time ago.
Vorks still struggles to understand.
You will take ship again, Lord?
He asks.
When the rift is complete, yes, Mortarion says. There are things I have seen, snatches of dreams that I never thought would be waked from. My brothers are stirring. You hear this? My brothers. Magnus revives his tedious old blood feud, but it will not end there. The few surviving loyal sons will be found again.
Mortarion chuckles.
Abaddon can do what he wishes. I no longer care for Terra. I was there and damaged it so deeply it will never recover. My business now is, you might say, within the family.
Vorks hears the words, no longer care for Terra, but does not take them in. That must have been some mistake, some lack of understanding on his part. But it is rare for Mortarion to speak loosely, despite all the vagaries and part prophecy that always litter his utterances.
I have seen this,
Mortarion says, cracking a half-smile that makes the puckered skin above his rebreather flex awkwardly.
I believe I am the first to do so. Gilliman will revive. The numbers tell me this, and I have traveled far within the garden to confirm it. There are groves that hiss his name in the wind. I look into pools and see his face staring at me. Gilliman. Stiff, dreary Gilliman. I'd have preferred another one. The lion, perhaps, whom I always quite admired. But one will do, even the dull one.
Vorks tries to decide how much of this is real and how much is hallucination. The age of the Primarchs is over. All know that. They are either dead or spirited into demigods whose interests bend away from the physical and into the metaphysical. It was a failed experiment, and one whose effects have been slowly dying for 10 millennia. The age of the Psyker is on the cusp of realization, the one that will bring the next great test for the species. That is what has been believed here for a long time. But he says nothing. There is a keen light in Mortarion's eyes now, where for many centuries there has only been emptiness, and it would be dangerous to query that.
He lives?
Vorks asks uncertainly.
He never died. His soul was bound to his body. You could see its echo in the warp if you knew where to look. But the day is coming. And here's the irony. The gate will break, and that shall release him.
Mortarion is drooling a little now. A speck of saliva hangs on the end of the rebreather, teetering at the point of falling.
I'll be there to meet him, Siege Master. I wish to have you by my side.
Vorks is still working hard to make sense of it all, but the last statement is what he has been wishing to hear for millennia.
The Legion entire, Lord.
The Legion entire, Siege Master, Mortarion says. I'm calling them back, cohort by cohort. We're still a force for all the erosions. We'll answer the Despoiler's call, and do so united. We'll help him break the gate, and once out, as the galaxy burns with warp fire and the stars go dark, we'll cleave our own path, not to the throne world, but to my brother's little kingdom.
Before he knows what he is doing, Vorks finds himself kneeling.
I did not dare to hope, he says.
He sees then, in that moment, just how truly powerful his Primarch has become. He had not realized how empty the campaigns have been without the Death Lord at their head. Despite all the decay, the infighting, all the many changes, Vaux is still a space marine, and somewhere within his addled innards he still possesses the gene seed that binds him tight to his master's will. Mortarion rises from the throne, an arthritic movement that sends dead skin cells shedding like grave spoil. He reaches out, extending a long, bulky arm, and lifts his warrior to his feet. The gesture is surprisingly deft, almost gentle.
"By my side," Mortarion says, "as we were before."
He is still smiling.
"Prepare your ship. Get your fighters ready for the muster. If you have any unfinished business with them, any flotsam to eject, do so now."
"How soon?" Vaux asks.
"I don't know."
Mortarion's wings extend as his body unfurls, and a carrion stench wafts out from under the gauzy shadow.
"But make no mistake, all will change. For us, for them, for everyone. We will be out. We will have freedom the likes of which the galaxy has not seen since he walked among us. How to use it? Now then, that is the test."
Three. Dark Imperium. Chapter 6. Administrator General Io Bhattacharya runs down the corridor. Her heart is thudding. She feels stress hormones coursing through her system, just as they have been for the last few weeks. She has not slept for a long time, not properly. When she has a rare pause in rushing around, she holds her hand to her face and sees it shaking. She reaches the slide doors and punches the code. Inside is the Sector Coordination Chamber. There are several hundred people there already, more than it was ever designed to accommodate. They are shouting. Many look like they're coming to blows, and there are shoving matches over tables. She pushes through them, looking for Makkard. Ducking past a furious-looking man with a torn jerkin, she spies him in earnest conversation with Windib. She makes her way towards them, swerving around more clusters of scared, angry people. Makkard sees her coming and gives her a weary smile.
"You got back, Io," he says,
coming to embrace her. She nods, noticing his stale aroma as he puts his big arms around her. That's not his fault. They've been stuck in these airless rooms for a long time. Windib nods at her curtly. She is not the hugging kind. Makkard gives her a concerned look.
"Find anything out?"
Bhattacharya shakes her head. "All nodes down, just like ours are." She can't stop her voice shaking a little. It's mostly from exhaustion, but they might mistake it for fear.
"That can't be right," says Windib. "It can't be."
Leonora Windib does not take easily to system failure. She is a creature of the system, her life devoted to ensuring Najan's products are grown, tested, harvested, and transported with maximum efficiency. She has power of life and death over the production carders, something she has exercised more than once, all in the service of system integrity. System integrity is life to her.
"Take a flyer yourself, then," says Bhattacharya, too tired to stay polite. "Try to find a functional node."
Makkard calmly places his hand on Windib's.
"We can stop pretending now, I think."
Olav Makkard is a reassuringly calm presence. He's a limited man, well-suited to being Magister Technicae, happiest with the engine seers of the big grain vacuums and hoversides out on the high resource. But in these kinds of situations, that's actually welcome. Bhattacharya tries to calm herself down. She moves closer to the other two to keep her words from traveling too far.
"So, this is the situation. Intrasystems comms down. Orbital grid down. Astropaths dead. Defense clusters down, as far as I can see. There might be something working on the far side of the planet, but it would take hours to find out."
Makkard's brow creases.
"What could do this?"
he muses. He sees the issue as a technical one and seems almost to take pleasure in its inscrutability. Electromagnetic burst? Not likely. Not everything. So what about the astropaths?
Bhattacharya remembers what it was like in the system local Tower of Sight, that old steel pinnacle just south of the main defense station. She'd been warned not to go into the sanctum by the thralls, but had ignored them. Then she'd vomited. A lot. It turns out there are worse ways to die than being caught up in the blades of an auto-thresher.
There were dedicated screeds on the auto-typist, just a few, she says. Mostly standard dream traffic. But then it all started going wrong. I don't understand any of it. One of them had begun drawing. Things... It was all horrible.
Windib is getting impatient.
News is getting out. We have 50,000 workers in this processor node alone, and once they start to panic...
No one's panicking, says Bhattacharya firmly. Where's Captain Dantin?
He couldn't raise a line to the garrison, so he took a crawler over, says Makard. Bhattacharya has a terrible feeling about all of this. It's more than physical. For months now, the nightmares have been terrible, and there's this awful sensation in the pit of her stomach. It started with those first long-range distress calls from the near void, all bleating something about the Astronomicon going out, which was absurd. But the Audix snippets just kept coming. And then the scheduled conveyors never turned up. That hadn't happened on Najan for as long as the records had been kept, more than 2,000 standard years. And then the lights had appeared in the night sky, first flickers that looked like shooting stars, then ripples of weird green and purple that made it impossible to sleep, and somehow got through even blackout shutters. And then the astropaths had started dying, and then the ranged comms had crackled out, and it began to seem very much like the universe was folding up on itself around them.
"Stay here," Bhattacharya says to Windib. "Get some more staff into the overlook units and calm everybody down. Get them going through the emergency protocols one by one."
"It won't do any good.
It'll give them something to do."
Bhattacharya turns to Makard.
"You have a crawler docked?"
The Magister Technicae nods.
"We'll take it out. I want to talk to Dantin."
The two of them start to march off, leaving Windib scuttling after them.
"What'll you get from him, Administrator?" she asks querulously. "He's just a soldier."
Bhattacharya swivels on her heel.
"You think we won't be fighting soon?" she hisses. "You think this is something natural? You stupid woman!"
Then she is marching again. Makard stares at the stricken Windib for a moment, then hurries after her.
"She could have you sanctioned," he says, sounding slightly awestruck.
"Thrown," she says, never looking back. "Scary prospect."
Najan is an agri-world. There are templates for such places, drawn up in the fathomless past and never altered by the Administratum. All agri-worlds are of similar size, located in similar orbital zones within their void systems, and subject to specific exposure to a prescribed spectrum of solar radiation. Their soils have to be within a tight compositional range, and they have to be close to major supply worlds. The Imperium is not a gentle custodian of such places. After discovery of a candidate planet, the first 50 years are spent in terraforming, according to well-worn Martian procedures. All pre-existing life is scrubbed from the rocks, either by the application of controlled virus chewers or by timed flame drops. The atmosphere is regulated, first through the actions of gigantic macroprocessors, and thereafter by a land-based network of control units, more commonly referred to as command nodes. Weather, at least as generally understood, disappears. Rainfall becomes a matter of controlled timing, governed by satellites in low orbit, and kept in line by fleets of dirigibles. The empty landscape is divided up into colossal production zones, each patrolled by crawlers and pest-thopters. Millions of base-level servitors are imported, kept at the very lowest level of cognitive function, but bulked up by a ruthless level of muscle-binders. Soon after this process completes, every agri-world looks exactly the same, a flat, wind-rummaged plain of high-yield crops swaying towards the empty horizon. A person could walk for days and never see a distinctive feature. Not that anyone sane would choose to walk in such places. The industrial fertilizer dumps are so powerful that they turn the air orange and make it impossible to breathe unfiltered.
A single growing season exhausts the soil completely, requiring continual delivery of more sprays of nitrates and phosphates, all delivered from the grimy berths of hovering dispatch flyers. The entire world is given over to a remorseless monoculture, with orthogonal drainage channels burning with chem residue and topsoil continually degrading into a flimsier and flimsier dust. But that doesn't matter. A planet can be driven like this for thousands of years before it eventually keels over and becomes a death world. The quality of the crops gets steadily worse, but the quantity can be sustained almost indefinitely, assuming that supply lines are maintained and imports remain consistent. At the end of every season, the great harvester leviathans are stoked up and dragged from their pens and let loose on the grey fields, smokestacks belching and tracked undercarriages sinking deep. These massive creatures of high-sided metal and intricate pipework, the smallest of which are 100 meters long, crawl across the blasted prairies, sucking up every last speck of pallid grain, and piping it directly to antiseptic internal hoppers. Feedlanders come down from high flight, dock with the still-trundling leviathans, and extract the raw material from where it is taken into the city-sized processor vats, blasted with antibiotics, smashed, burned, crushed, then stamped and packaged. Once ready for transport, containers are dragged up into orbit aboard swell-bellied landers, ready for transfer to the void-bound mass conveyors, which deliver the refined product to every starving hive world and forge world in their long circuits. There is a quaint tradition in the various propaganda departmentos of the administratum of marketing agri-worlds as quasi-paradises, free of the squalor and overcrowding of a standard urban station, and full of bucolic ease. Vidcards are dropped into communal habwarrens, extolling the virtues of a life lived outdoors, with a son on your back and a ruddy-faced boy or girl, subject to preference, by your side. In reality, life on an agri-world is as unrelenting, back-breaking and monotonous as the vast majority of other imperial vocations. There are no trees laden with glossy fruit, only kilometre after kilometre of hissing corn. There are no gentle strolls under the warming sun, only punishing work details in rad suits, leaning into the dust-laden winds that howl around the equator with nothing to halt their rampage. Once the new arrivals have made planetfall and found this out, it is too late. Crew transports arrive on agri-worlds full and leave empty. There is a saying among the indentured workers, "You come for the soil, you end up part of it." Najan is no different. Its bulk is taken up exclusively with 7 approved strains of nutrient-enriched grains, overseen by the Central Command Station midway up the Northern Hemisphere. 3 million servitors work the resource, the hyperfields, while little more than 200,000 people, less than the complement of a single spire on a mid-range hive world, control the stock of semi-automated vehicles and monitor the lattice of weather control nodes. There are 3 garrisons housing a few 100 under-trained sub-militarum-grade troopers, an astropath tower, a rudimentary orbital defense grid, a navy station, and a few other dusty offices for the various divisions of the administratum, rarely manned. Najan's quotas are unremarkable, its operations firmly within the expectations of the subsector command. Keeping it that way is hard work, but it is better to keep your head down than invite a visit from the off-world Scrutius Signa Quantitatis, who make Windib look like the soul of levity and carry splinter rifles. But Acharya reflects bitterly on that as Makard's crawler shakes and sways across the short piece of open ground between the command station and Dantine's primary garrison building. The view screens are, as ever, smeared from the endless wind. She is hot, her work habits stained at the armpits and collar. These places are not intended to be properly defensible. Their survival is predicated on rapid response from the system's naval assets, who prowl the void incessantly. All she has ever been required to do is to keep the astropaths happy, maintain a skeleton defense crew to buy a little time if ever required, and keep the comm stations manned. In Najan's 2,000 years of uninterrupted activity, the worst that has taken place is a Xenos raid, some 500 years ago. That is legend now, a piece of old news they can laugh about in the canteens. "We're due a naval visit," says Makard, bouncing on the high driver's seat as the crawler lurches along. "They might be able to explain all this."
Bhattacharya smiles bitterly. I don't think there'll be a visit.
There's one due.
They're not coming, Olav. I don't know if there even is a navy anymore, at least in this subsector.
Makard